My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Chelsea Kane. Chelsea, welcome to All Classical.
Thank you, Ed. We did it.
We did it. Yes, finally. I've missed talking to you for so long now. It's annoying to me. I don't even want to deal with it, except to say, in the interest of full disclosure, you and I have been friends for quite a long time.
Yeah, like 45 years now.
Easily, yeah. It could be 107, at least since Confessions of a Teen Sleuth came out. And that was, what, 2005, 10 years ago?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I knew you before then in any case. But
yeah. No, I would just duck behind tables when I saw you coming.
That's right. I actually saw you do that once, but I decided not to, you know, not to take it personally because it might have been somebody behind me.
Could have been.
Yeah, yeah. I will talk about your most recent book, which is called One Kick. It's published by, who is it published by? Is this
Simon & Schuster.
Yeah. I recognize their logo finally. And your name, of course, is Chelsea Kane, last name spelled C-A-I-N. Let's talk a little bit about that first book I talked to you about, Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. And I liked it because, A, it was very clever and a satire on all of those Encyclopedia Brown and
Nancy Drew.
Nancy Drew, all of those teen sleuths that the Hardy Boys that populated, they're actually in the book too,
yeah.
that populated young adult literature, wasn't even called that in those days, back in the 20s and 30s and 40s. I read a bunch of those books, and I assume you did too.
Oh, yes.
And did that make you want to become a crime writer?
Reading all of those books?
Yeah.
It made me the kind of kid who, when other kids wanted to play house, I wanted to play get chloroformed. I didn't know like what a sap was, but I knew if somebody hit you with one, you ended up in the back of a trunk.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, it made me want to be a detective in real life, I guess, more than write about detectives. Although that's what I did. I always wrote mysteries, which would be, I guess, different than crime genre-wise. But I came to Confessions because I had written at that point nonfiction, and I had written a lot of kind of voicey journalism that I'm using air quotes, which your listeners can't see, which is not to say like nothing hard hitting, you know, it's all just very kind of sort of snarky journalism. And I was trying to figure out how to write a novel because I couldn't. I kept trying and I would write a bunch of pages. I could do that. I could write a ream of paper, but none of it ever hung together. And I thought that writing a parody would be a good way to kind of write a novel with training wheels because there's a form to it, obviously. And at the time, there were all of those books that were coming out that told great literature, at least well-known, loved literature from another point of view, like Ahab's Wife and The Wind Done Gone. And this was part of this sort of cultural discussion at the time. And so I thought, like, because I, as a writer and reader, was kind of both attracted to that idea and offended by it. but I thought, like, wow, if I were to do that, like, spend, like, a year writing a book, like, using someone else's characters and, you know, like get that deep into the work, like what would be the most important piece of work in my life that I would feel that connection to? And I thought, well, Nancy Drew books, obviously. I sold that book based on a pitch, and it was Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. It was Nancy Drew looking back on her life, setting the record straight. And it was supposed to be just Nancy Drew satire, but I realized quickly that that wouldn't sustain itself. So I brought in everybody. Trixie Belden is in that book. Terry Ames,
yes,
who's just
the nurse
who could never keep a job. She was like a private duty nurse in one book and then cruise ship nurse in the next one. Ranch nurse.
Good way to move her around and get into it.
Yeah. Clearly. I never liked her, though.
Really? Seriously?
I really didn't.
Yeah, I read one book and I knew it wasn't for me, but I did read one book. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in what you said about not being able to get a novel out of a bunch of pages because I've been that way myself. And the worst advice I ever got, and this was from a friend who meant well, the worst advice I ever got was, think of it as a collection of short stories.
Yeah.
And that was a terrible idea.
Yeah. And the vice versa, which is advice I get a lot when I tell people that I can't write a short story, they just say, well, it's just a chapter of a novel. And it's like, no, both of those things are false.
Yeah. Maybe somebody could. I mean, I've read what they call a novel in stories.
Right.
And that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. And I think it's thin ice for a lot of people to do a thing like that because there's no... You want some continuity in a novel. You want a spine for the story. You want several a story arc with several subplots, and it doesn't work in a situation like that.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I think it's very ambitious to write those sort of short story novels, and I do think when they work really beautifully. But they're different shapes, you know, they're different story shapes. And I just did not know how to write fiction, like in a really kind of basic sense. Like I was a kid who wrote all the time. I was a kid who at 8 years old was spending 6 hours in my room writing a novel.
Seriously?
And I was a pretentious.
That's not pretentious, that's ambitious.
So-and-so. So I was very good at producing pages and got a lot of positive feedback from adults because I could produce pages, which is impressive to adults. Yet, like in college, I took a lot of like journalism classes. I wrote for the college paper and I wrote my own kind of fiction, but I'd never took fiction courses. And then I got a graduate degree in journalism. And again, like did a lot of like essay classes and literary nonfiction classes, but no fiction, like just basic kind of stuff. Like this is how you write point of view. I just didn't have the tools. And it took one, just a lot of failing, writing books over and over again. And that is useful to just kind of get a sense of, again, the shape of how to write a longer story. But I really had to sit with I joined a writing group and I had to sit with them for 3 hours every week and just get taught how to do it, just kind of a master class, because I wrote from such an intuitive place that it was incredibly useful. I can't even tell you. Like if you want to write fiction, it's useful to take a couple of classes. That is my advice.
That's funny because when I taught writing classes, the very first thing I said to the very first day of class was, please let this be your last writing class. Just go home and write, because that's the way you're going to learn to do it. And I've also been involved in writing groups, and I've never found one that I was satisfied with. So I had the opposite experience of you with your writing group, which turned out to be a great help. But one of my the things I live by is that if you're a person who reads a lot, you've absorbed a lot about story structure, about dialogue, about characterization. You may not even know it. And the thing to do is to try to tap into that and unlock that knowledge.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true, that you can get a base level, again, of intuitive storytelling skills. And certainly near for dialogue and even phrasing. You know, there are tricks to writing, whether it is how to resolve tension and not resolve tension, whether it's how to, the fact that two sentences together in dialogue have more tension than three, that three sentences resolve tension, that an object accrues meaning every time it's mentioned. Again, you know, point of view, which I think you could spend a lifetime studying, it's incredibly useful. And there are tricks. I mean, that's such a silly word to use, but there are tricks. They're tools that you can learn about and put in your box, and they're there. And I think that unless you are the kind of person who, and I think these people are out there who can look as a reader out of work and really deconstruct it, which I think is very useful. It's a very useful process, and really figure out why it's working. I think you can read all the books you want, and unless you're really deconstructing them, you're going to miss some of what is being done that makes them good.
Mm-hmm. Well, that requires a toolkit. You need to have a set of tools with which to deconstruct and to be able to analyze what you're seeing and what you're reading. And that we don't all have that. I don't know. I don't know how to phrase this exactly, except to say that some people can do it with more ease without any coaching than others can. And I realize that's banal and almost meaningless, but it's true, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I still think people should. I think it's useful to take a class. And I was lucky in the sense that I joined a writing group of people who are all much smarter than I am.
I don't know anybody smarter than you.
No,
are.
Like I can pick a lock a lot faster.
Useful skill?
In the sense that they either all had MFAs or had all spent a lot of time studying writing in a formalized sense.
So they know about the craft of writing.
Yeah. They were able to bring a lot of even just shared vocabulary, which is really useful, so that you know you're all talking about the same thing when you look at a work. It was great.
Do you, you mentioned something before that reminded me of something a playwright said. I don't think it was Ibsen, but it was somebody like him who said, if you show the audience a hunting rifle in Act One, it has to go off by the end of the play.
Oh, it's Chekhov. Chekhov's
gun. Chekhov,
yeah.
Yeah, okay. Do you subscribe to that point of view?
Sure. No, I mean, yeah, Chekhov's gun, absolutely. I think it can be kind of clumsy and obvious. That's the trick. But you know what I'm talking about more is, and again, that goes back to point of view. If you describe a room, you're in a character's point of view, like a third person close point of view. And so the person, you know, anything in the room that we're learning about as a reader, we're learning through the filter of that point of view. So anything that person notices is going to be important to who they are. And he notices the vase on the table, right? So we notice the vase on the table. And then the scene goes on and we go back to the vase on the table. It's mentioned again. And now suddenly we're like, well, why is he noticing it? Like, what is it about the vase? Why is the vase important? He looks at it a third time. And now we're watching the vase in a whole new way. That vase is important. Did his dead mother, like, did she give him the vase? Are her ashes in the vase? We don't know. Is there a gun in the vase? But it's important. And I think that kind of guidance is really interesting, especially, you know, in any kind of writing. But I find it very useful in thriller writing and what I do now.
Oddly, a lot of women mystery writers started out as romance writers. And I think that the thing that they get from romance is the way to structure a novel, create a mood, and the way to characterize people that they want to perform certain functions. So they have that. And I think that romance novels are peculiarly focused on things like that, as are genre novels like crime novels.
Well, no, it's, I mean, I'll tell you. What I see is the similarity between romance and thrillers is tension.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're learning to write tension.
Yeah, but of course in a romance novel, you always know how the tension's going to be resolved, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't write romance novels.
No, neither do I. And I try not to read too many, although I have read a couple in my time, and there are good ones and bad ones. Let's put it that way.
And my Archie Sheridan Gretchen Lowell series, that is a love story. It is a mm-hmm. twisted love story between a detective and a serial killer. And that tension is just as, I think, probably more exquisite than the sense of danger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, we're going to get into that right now. We have to remind our listeners that you are Chelsea Kane. And I thank you again for coming. And this is going to be following you around for the rest of your life, a New York Times bestseller author.
Yes. Say it again, Ed.
A New York Times bestselling author. And the Gretchen Lowell Archie Sheridan series is a thing probably that puts you on the map. And One Kick is your latest novel, not a Gretchen Lowell novel.
Correct.
Hard for me to say. A romance between Gretchen and Archie. As I recall, and was it Heartsick was the first one?
Mm-hmm.
In the very first scene, Gretchen is doing things to Archie that lovers normally don't do to one another. But normally is not the right word either, as a rule.
It depends what you're into.
I suppose that's exactly why I wanted to change that. As a rule, lovers don't do to one another. You want to describe the first scene in that book?
Oh, she's torturing him.
Ah, yes. Driving nails into his ribs.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then she lets him go, which is quite charitable.
Yeah, either that or she just wants to save him for another time.
That is the question, isn't it?
But I know a lot of people who couldn't get past that first chapter. They said, I can't read this book.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run into that a lot?
Were they carpenters?
No. No, I think they're sensitive people.
Sensitive people, the lily-livered. Oh, yes.
See, that's why I like you. I never realized I truly disturbed you until I read your books.
Yeah, my husband said the same thing.
I know, he told me that. We were comparing notes once.
No, I think that first chapter is a good call, frankly, for people who are like, okay, yeah, this is not for me. That's fair enough.
Yeah, well, there are strong women in your book. Gretchen Lowell is certainly a strong woman.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, I can't remember the reporter's name.
Susan Ward.
Susan Ward, mm-hmm. who develops into a strong woman. She's haunted by her overweening mother, and she's a little insecure about a lot of things. But mm-hmm. over the book, she develops into a fairly strong person and a real help for Archie Sheridan, who's a Portland police detective.
Yeah. No, it's been fun to kind of watch Susan evolve. It was, you know, she is a character who by necessity often has to do the wrong thing in order to allow me to move the story forward. I have definitely tried to make her, as you say, like I like that description that she is a little bit insecure about a lot of things. I think that's very astute.
Oh,
and, you know, becoming less and less so as time goes by. But, you know, it's interesting to me about the way that people discuss those books is that, and you did this as well, many people refer to them as the Gretchen Lowell books. I mean, Gretchen Lowell doesn't have a point of view in those books. They alternate between Archie and Susan for the most part, with occasional other characters. We never get inside Gretchen's head. We never know what she's thinking, which is key to both tensions, romantic, for lack of a better word, and danger tensions going on in those in that whole series. If we know what she's thinking, we lose both of those. But her character is so big, and she is so present on the page when she is present that she kind of overpowers and overshadows everybody else in a lot of ways. There's one book in that series that she is not in. She's just in like a couple pages at the end. And I wrote it really to kind of prove to myself that I could do it. But man, I missed her so much. Like the book after that is really gory. So just had to, Gretchen comes with a lot of stabbing, you know?
She's one of those fraught characters that when she is present on the page, readers know that anything can happen and something will. And I think that, I mean, what you've created a character that basically sets up her own universe and then proceeds to live in it.
Yeah.
And makes us do it too.
And you know what's funny is, I mean, Gretchen Lowell's a serial killer. Like in the book, like she's killed, you know, hundreds of people, they think. And she does it creatively and with a lot of enthusiasm. She's not a good person, but I am amazed at how many, especially like women, young women will come up to me at events, say something along the lines of, and this has actually been said to me verbatim, I find Gretchen Lowell so inspiring. And I, at first I would gasp. And sort of back away and look around to see if there are any booksellers around who could whisk me away. But, you know, and then I would think like, God, you know, what does she mean by that? And should I be writing these books? And then I realized finally that Gretchen Lowell, she is a character that an archetype that almost never see in literature aimed for women. And that is she a female character who does not experience self-doubt. Women are portrayed in culture, and clearly it resonates because it wouldn't be a trope, right, if it didn't. But no matter how high functioning they are professionally, they're always paralyzed by, you know, their relationships with boys or their, you know, their body image or, you know, like there's just saturated anxiety in female characters. And I think that Gretchen Lowell, for all of her faults, she doesn't apologize and she doesn't explain. She doesn't offer excuses. She just does what she loves. And there's something empowering about that, I think, or at least fun to experience vicariously.
Yeah, Rap Brown, back in the 60s when he was a Black Power advocate, said there is no one more dangerous than a man who has nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. And this is, in fact, a corollary to that. If you feel like you can do whatever you want, because no matter what happens, it could either can't get any better or can't get any worse, then that frees you up. It said, was it the path to enlightenment leads through the valley of horror or something, you know, and all things are, nothing is forbidden, all things are possible. There's a mindset that says that once you've freed yourself of the conventions that are supposed to dictate to you, then you are the only free agent in the world.
Yeah. I guess it's the upside of being a psychopath.
I knew there would be one of those. I'd like to talk a little bit about One Kick. Now, I have heard from women who have read your books or tried to read your books that the women in your books either perpetrate or have experienced terrible personal violence. And we don't know that much about Gretchen. I mean, we don't know what her backstory is, really.
Right.
So who knows what happened to her to make Gretchen Lowell? Because the common wisdom, if in fact there's such a thing about psychopaths, is that they've learned not to care about other people because they have been treated badly themselves.
Right. Gretchen, like, that is very purposeful that Gretchen, again, like, I didn't want to explain her. That felt like a cheat and a way that it would undermine her power in a way that I didn't want to do. And so she's also not a textbook psychopath. I have never implied that she was the victim of violence growing up.
You never implied anything about her much, except that she cares deeply for Archie Sheridan.
Yeah, for whatever reason.
For whatever reason. That's it. Now, in One Kick, your most recent book, which is a 2014 publication.
No, let's talk more about this.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
So the fact that women, because, you know, I would say that I write thrillers in all of the characters in my books, the men and the women. I mean, certainly in One Kick, they've all experienced violence on both sides. I mean, to a person, we can go through and, you know, I think that that's absolutely not true, that it's the women somehow who experience more violence than the men. No one has, I have never done any, like, more damage to any character than I have to Archie Sheridan. Like, every scar I give that man, I feel him sometimes look back at me and it's like, really? Really?
Do you know any cops on the Portland force?
No.
No? Okay. I was wondering if any of them has read your book and what one or two might think about it.
Yeah, I mean, I hear from a surprising number of law enforcement fans.
The crime slash thriller community has a vast number of people in it, each of whom is attracted to it for different reasons. And whenever I get into one of those chat rooms or listservs or whatever it is, and I start reading some of these things, I'm always astounded at what is going on in people's minds.
Hmm.
Okay. That, talk about a dead end. Okay. Kick Lanigan. Kick Lanigan used to be known as Beth, and she participated in the Beth movies. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, her backstory, Kick Lanigan's backstory, is that she was abducted as a young kid and spent 5 years with her abductor before she was rescued at age 11. And now she's 21. Like, that's, you know, the age she is in the course of events of the book. She's grown up as much as you can be at 21, which is probably more than most 21-year-olds. And she has learned all these cool skills to make her feel safe in the world. And she ends up investigating crimes with a partner who sort of walks into her life. But the Beth movies are a series of pornographic films that she made with her abductor, was forced to make with her abductor, that haunt her still because they're on the internet. And once they're on the internet, there's no getting them down. And that is based on a story in the New York Times magazine that came out many years ago, not too many, four, that kind of got me thinking about One Kick and in the Kick Lanigan series in general. And it was a story about a young woman who's 19 or 20 who participated in a lawsuit working its way, or a criminal case, or not a criminal case, a lawsuit, legislation, new law,
yeah,
working its way up the system that would allow women, because it is usually women. It's a very complicated legal case, and I'm trying to simplify it. She
should be able to sue everybody who's ever downloaded one of those movies.
God, you simplified it so beautifully, Ed.
Well, that's really, I follow
well
that case
done.
As well.
Yeah, which is fascinating, fascinating. And, you know, there are these cases where, you know, these women, like her, the guy who molested her on film had gone to jail, right? She'd grown up. He was out at this point, you know, like he'd done his 10 years time. And yet her life is still defined by these images that she, you know, she can't get off the internet. And she, because of the victim notification laws, gets notified every time somebody gets busted with a hard drive with her picture on it. And because people who enjoy child pornography don't just keep one image. If you're going to do that, you crossed a line, you know, and you might as well just apparently download as many as you can. So anytime one of these guys is arrested, there are thousands and thousands of images. And all of those kids who are grown up or not receive victim notification letters if the person has been prosecuted. It's just so interesting to me. It's such a metaphor for our baggage being haunting us, just not being able to escape how other people define you, which is very much what Kick Lanigan, what that series is about. She is someone, like, she chose her name, Kick, because she was no longer Beth. Her original name was Kit. And when she was taken, her abductor told her name was Beth. Kit was dead. She became Beth. And when she was rescued and went back to her family, she wasn't Beth anymore. Now, Beth was dead, but she's also not Kit anymore. So she calls herself Kick. And even as a 21-year-old who has all of this power, and I wanted to write this series because I wanted to write a protagonist who, unlike Archie Sheridan, had agency, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So she has a lot of agency, but she is still defined by other people's ideas of her. And she is famous the way that Elizabeth Smart is famous, you know, where people know her story, where she was on the cover of magazines, and everybody who sees her knows she is this girl who was kidnapped and rescued. Everybody thought she was dead, and she came back. She was rescued.
Yeah, I watch way too many police procedurals on television, and the CSIs and the Law and Orders, each of them have done several programs based on this premise that these things follow people around even after they're rescued, even after they go to the shrinks and are able to get a job and finish school. And this stuff follows them around forever, and somebody will always have a Beth movie,
right,
that, and say, I know you're from somewhere.
Right, right.
And then it's,
it all
comes back.
Yeah.
Pretty terrible stuff. I once spoke to Ruth Rendell, who I think is one of the greatest living crime writers. And she writes about truly disturbed individuals, especially in her. She has another persona. I can't think of the pseudonym now. But when she writes these books, she takes the English class system, which kind of warps people in a way anyway, and then adds the psychological thing, and it turns them into stark raving loonies.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurs to me that if you write that stuff, there's got to be some blowback. And I actually asked her that question in an interview, and she said, "Oh, no, at 5 o'clock, I wash my hands, have a cup of tea." That's it.
Yeah.
How about you?
I agree. I get asked that a lot, how I function if I'm haunted by the world I inhabit during the day when I'm working. But I would not write this stuff if I were haunted by it. I think the whole, it's also what puzzles me when people say that my books give them nightmares. I always say, well, you should not read my books. That's terrible.
Yes.
Because I don't get nightmares from books. I feel very safe in the world, probably overly safe. And that has allowed me to have a very dark imagination. I'm a vegetarian, right? Because I have a violent imagination. I am able to write books that are adventure stories that don't haunt me at all.
Do you believe in another one of my tenets is that writing is the cheapest form of psychotherapy? Do you believe that you get things out, you lance certain psychic boils by writing what you do?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm in the unique position where if I'm on the way to the radio station today, I did not take my husband's super secret route. I went the way that a normal person would, and I got stuck behind a train.
Yes.
Which is what he said would happen. And there I was, and there's this train, and God, the trains go through. They slow down when they see you waiting. And then it finally passed, and I was just so full of rage. And I thought, I get to go home and kill someone. Yeah, I will leave the radio station, I will go home, and I will kill someone on the page, and I will feel so much better. And very few people get to do that.
It's a good day to kill someone today. Yeah. Yeah, the trains are annoying, but not much more than that. Chelsea, what are you working on now? Is it more Gretchen Lowell, or are you branching out?
It's another Kick book,
uh-huh.
Another Kick Lanigan book, yep, number two.
Is Gretchen in abeyance for a while? What do you think?
No, I will go back and do another Archie Gretchen book next. I just had to do two Kick books to kind of establish it as a series, and then I'll alternate. That's the plan.
Yeah, somebody who's achieved your level of success may not remember this, but when I first got my first book published, they said, "So is this going to be a series?" And I hadn't even thought about it, and I said, "Well, okay." And then I realized, sure, I like the characters a lot. I could do a lot with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had people tell me that they tried to sell a series and the publisher was, "Oh, no, we just want a one-off," you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do whatever you want. Thank heaven for you. But what, I guess the question emerging from all this verbiage is, do publishers really know what the hell people want to read?
No. first of all, my publisher, they would love me to do a one-off. They would love that. It's just not how my mind works. It's just not interesting to me. I get too attached to the characters. Even when I read series, like when I read thrillers, I like there to be a couple more on the shelf, because otherwise it is. You are putting yourself through kind of an emotional roller coaster and you get attached to the characters and want to see them again. And I feel the same way about writing about the characters. I don't want to spend a year with them and then say goodbye. And also just the kind of long form story where most of my series, most of my books all are concerned with past events, with the kind of the history of the characters that get unpacked over the course of the series as it unfolds. So what we're learning as readers about the characters, it's all stuff that happened long before the series even started. It's just sort of illuminating who they are. It's them sort of seeing themselves opposed to changing.
Every time I talk to you, I realize the conversation could go on for hours. At least I think it could. Yeah. I'd really like to thank you for coming in. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Chelsea Cain. Her last name is spelled C-A-I-N. Her most recent book is One Kick, a Kick Lanigan book, and there will be another. And then back to Gretchen and Archie and the love story that endures.
Absolutely. You want to know what the second Kick book is?
Sure.
Can you guess?
Two Kicks?
No.
Don't know then.
Kick back.
Kick back. Oh, got me there. Well, I hope you will kick back here when the book is published. Do you know when it's coming out?
January.
There we go. January 2016. My goodness. Where's my jetpack?
I don't know. It's in the lobby. I stepped right over it.
Thanks, Chelsea.
You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.